Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Now listen to the best from June of this year. It is the Savage Nation. Let's have some rock and roll for all of you deadheads out there. Redheads included. Runaround Sue. Wait a minute, stop the music. I didn't ask for Runaround Sue. I asked for something about There Goes My Baby, or Little Girl of Mine. What run around? So give me Little Girl of Mine. We're talking about Elena Kagan today. I mean, they gave her pearls. They gave her makeup. They gave her a hairdo. But basically, she's never been a judge. So if you like a Banana Republic, you have one now under Obama. This has happened before in Banana Republics, where they choose a relative whose last known job was working in a beauty parlor, or in this case, working at Harvard, which is about one and the same thing. You know, the real question is a world without shrimp because of the Gulf disaster. Stop it. If I were on the Judiciary Committee today, I would ask Kagan what she thinks about a world without shrimp. Because to the people from the Upper West Side, the area that she comes from, I think a world without shrimp is sort of a world without sunshine. And I don't know whether they would be willing to go to war for shrimp rights off the coast of China, or shrimp rights off the coast of India. Anyhow, you don't know what I'm talking about. Here's a little story I'm going to get to today that you heard nowhere else because it came out a minute ago. 10 alleged Russian secret agents arrested in the U.S. I almost fell down. I don't know why that we would arrest Russian secret agents when we already have the equivalent in the White House. I don't understand that. How would the FBI arrest 10 alleged Russian secret agents for wanting to penetrate policy-making positions when Obama and his minions have already done that? I don't quite understand that. I mean, it gives me hope to think that there's actually a piece of the government that has not yet been compromised. Five reasons to oppose Elena Kagan's Supreme Court nomination. One, she's never been a judge. Let me start with she's never been a judge. Today, yours truly, this talk show host, Michael Savage, went to a local hardware store to buy a flag, an American flag in a local hardware store, for the July 4th weekend that's coming up, so I could proudly hang it from my balcony. Living as I do in a liberal bastion, I could not find an American flag readily. I found rainbow flags, People's Republic of China flags, assorted mockeries of American flags. So they sent me to a back room where they had some American flags hidden next to antiquated parts. And, of course, I picked up the biggest one I can get made in China. And I ran into a very nice lady who is the wife of a local judge who I happen to know. She said, "Hi, Michael, how are you?" I said, "Oh, how are you? How are you?" I said, "How's the judge doing?" And she said to me, "Oh, well, you know, he's had Alzheimer's now for a few years." And I said, "Well, I bet he still knows more about being a judge than Kagan does." And, of course, we had a laugh over that, but it's really not funny. It's unbelievable. A judge with Alzheimer's in America would know more about the courts than Kagan. You know, there's an old adage, if you put pearls on a you-know-what, it's still a you-know-what. Whatever. I can tell already everyone's on vacation. I just have an instinct for radio. This is the summertime already. Deep, deep, heavy-duty summertime blues. People are already in another world. And they really only care about two things. There's a world without pornography. If the internet were to be cut off, I would think that they'd rather go to war over a world without the internet porn or a world without shrimp. I don't think they'd go to war over anything else. The Supreme Court today ruled 5-4 that you have a right to bear arms. Again, one vote between you and an absolute helplessness against the tyrannical government. And here we have a Supreme Court nomination going on, and you think that she's qualified when she's not qualified. Now, look, I'm a realist. I know Obama's a radical, and I know he would appoint a liberal to replace a liberal. That's one thing. But to replace a reasonable liberal with a reasonable liberal is one thing. But to replace a reasonable liberal with an unqualified stooge like Kagan is an embarrassment. But this is what happens when you seek the lowest common denominator. We sorted in a president, then we got Obama, and now we're seeking the lowest common denominator in judicial nominees. That's all. So let me tell you another story from the weekend. Are you listening to me on the Savage Nation? Do you know the phone number? Do you know the website? Do you know that I have ringtones available now? You didn't know about ringtones. You realize you could get a ringtone on your cell phone that answers liberalism as mental disorder? Think about how you could shake up a supermarket or a coffee shop. Instead of your phone ringing, it goes, me and my voice. Hey, you, liberalism is a mental disorder. Pick up your damn phone. You can only get it on michaelsavage.com. I'm doing it for fun. I'm going to get rich from it. I'm not going to get rich or poor from it. It's not going to change my lifestyle one iota, but it's going to shake your life up. So yesterday, this talk show host went out on his little boat, his 22-foot boat. I have a little boat and a big boat. Sometimes I don't use the big boat because it's too much trouble. Anyway, I use the little boat because it's easy. Little, you know, something small is beautiful in most things, not all. But in some things, small is beautiful, and particularly in a boat. So it's 22 feet long with a little like cabin on it. It's a sort of mini tug. It's a fake tugboat. It has a three-cylinder Yamaha engine, 29 horsepower. It sips fuel by the pint. It seats eight people on the back with cushions. It looks like a little runabout. It's extremely seaworthy. So I, Mrs. S., and the two poodles get in the boat, and we head over about, I don't know, maybe 50 minutes away. There's a place with a dock. I'm not going to say where. Now, normally on a weekend, it's jammed. Jammed. You can't get on a dock. There's only room for like 6, 8, 10 boats, and it's usually full, as it was yesterday. So luckily, I'm a very good boater, and I found an end. It's a narrow dock, right? And it's all full on both sides, boat dock. But there's a little piece of the dock that's 2-3 feet wide by the post that has cleats. I pulled it on the side, and I was able to dock it and tie it up. And one of us goes and gets the food. The dogs are on the boat, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, there's a fat slob in a sailboat who's bothering me. He wants to edge me out of there by making me uncomfortable, by nosing his boat near me. This goes on for 30 minutes now, and I don't say anything. He's nosing up. His engine is running. His schmuck son is blowing his cigarette smoke at me. And I see it's going to be trouble. Now, in my earlier days, I would have stood up and said something to him, but I knew right away it would have turned bad. But since I have learned to temper my temper, I figured, what am I going to gain by getting into a screaming fight with this fat pig right now? I'll just bide my time, and I'm going to turn my back on him, and I'm not going to respond. Meanwhile, the schmuck's hovering and motoring and engine and moving and constantly, in other words, like nosing at me and menacing me. Lo and behold, about 30 minutes of this goes by, and the missus returns with the food because you can't bring dogs in this joint. The dogs are too high class compared to the average person that sits there getting stoned and drunk on the deck. So she brings the food over. As she brings the food over, the guy next to me is going to pull out of the dock. So I said, great, I'll tell you what. I'll move in you. You'll move out there, right? And we'll rope it around. It was very friendly. And meanwhile, Mr. Fat Schmuck with the sailboat, he thinks he's going to slip into the guy who's pulling out while I'm waiting. So I say, hey, I'm going in there. You're going to go over there. And he says, no, I'm going in there. The minute I said that, an Italian guy shows up with like a cutoff. His name, I'm not going to say his name, with a gold cross. And he comes over. He says, hey, can I help you? He comes over to help me. He didn't know me now, remember, at that point. He just was a nice guy whose boat was nearby. Hey, let me help you move the boat around. I said, well, I don't know who you are, but I'm glad you showed up because there's going to be a little trouble here in a minute with that fat slob there who's going to try and edge me out. He says, Michael, don't you remember me? Anyway, I had an interchange. This guy knew this guy from somewhere before a few years ago. One of my biggest fans. He's from Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, but he lives out here. And he says to me, you want me to throw him in the water? He says, hey, guys. And all of a sudden, four more Italian guys come off the dock, heavily muscled guys with cutoffs and crosses. I mean, this is an anomaly in polite, backstabbing Marin County filled with the worst of types of humans who smile at you and put a knife in your back. You know the type of nice white guy that I'm talking about. Big smile in front and a knife in the back. Oh, wonderful people. Never an honest word comes out of their lips. But these guys are straight-up Brooklyn guys, and he starts in, hey, guys, you know who's here? This is Michael Savage. He has a big radio show. So everyone's looking. He's glowering at the guy in the sailboat. The guy in the sailboat still don't get it, that he's a minute away from losing his boat and his head. And I said, no, calm down. You don't have to do anything. And the guy's, well, my mother's here from New York, and my father's here from New York, and my father-in-law, we're all Sicilians, and he used to listen to you till he died. He said, you're the only person in America who says anything like it is. It was one of those great moments that is very hard for me to translate. I'm trying to give it to you, like, in a verbal way, but it's a human thing that you can't really describe. You have to have lived through it. Now, I'm not a guy who meets people off the air. I go out of my way to be very anonymous, and I don't talk. If I raise my voice, people know me, or if I say, Teddy, people will stop and say, is that Teddy, and are you Michael? I say, that's Teddy, but I don't know who Michael is. But in this case, I said yes, and we had a wonderful time. The long and short of it is all the boats got moved properly. The fat slob moved the sailboat quietly and meekly into the second tier. And I said, hey, guys, this is so beautiful. Bring your parents down off the... He says, Mike, I got to tell you about my mother. She's in from New York for a week. I told her we're coming across the bay in my boat to go for lunch at a certain place. She made me a meatball sandwich to bring to a restaurant because she don't like the food out here. I said, that is so beautiful. I said, I want to meet your mother. She made him a meatball hero to bring with him. I mean, the guy's a man. He's not a child. But the mother made him a meatball hero to bring to a restaurant because she knew the food would be garbage, you know. So it was that kind of thing. So we're sitting there, and he brings mom. I loved her. Brings mom over. I actually sang her a song when she showed up because my mother passed a long time ago. And I love real people more than anything on earth. When you live in a land of the phony, a real person is one of the greatest bombs that you can have. BALMS, okay? So I have mom and dad. I said, you get on my boat. Get him on the boat. He said, oh, Mike, it'll be like, you're from the Bronx. We're from Brooklyn. He said, this will be like the stoop. He said, we'll pull chairs out and we'll talk. And meanwhile, he commandeered. He took over the whole dock. Everybody, he was telling what to do and this and that, but in a nice way. So I had him on the boat. We had a couple of beers. We exchanged emails, you know, and it was that. And here I wake up to a world without shrimp. I'll be right back.
Savage.
And here is a gift for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010. Now listen to the best from June of this year. So you already got the flag story in the hardware store, and you got the Vinny story from the dock. I mean, you're already ahead of the curve for listening to the show. I mean, you know, you can get politics from me, too. You'll get that. The Kagan, you know, little things like that, like an unqualified stooge from Harvard who'll be on the court for about 50 years, making your life and your children and grandchildren's lives miserable. But you already heard that. So... I mean, that's what I thought I'd tell you about the flag in the hardware store and the Vinny story. The dock was really amazing. I came home feeling, like, different. I've lived in a land of the empty phony for so long I got used to it. I mean, that's how I created the Savage Nation. I really never told you that. In other words, what motivates a man to create a virtual world on a radio show called the Savage Nation? What motivates a man to do this? And where do I get the energy to do it? It comes from living in a vacuum. It comes from living in a void of phonies. Such severe, backstabbing, fraudulent, liberal white people that you've never seen anything like the people here. Smile to your face and stab you in the back day in and day out. Empty souls, every last one of them. So when this thing happens on a dock, I've had a run in on that dock a year or two, but I never went back because of it. The nasty people. They see an older guy and his wife and they figure you're vulnerable. They don't know how violent my temper can be. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not Mr. Tough Guy, but you know what? Any man, when he has to stand his ground, will stand his ground. I don't care who he is. So anyway, I try to avoid incidents like this. I didn't go back, but I wanted to go back because I enjoy going up there with getting the food with the dogs to kick. And this guy to show up out of nowhere, but I mean out of central casting. I don't just mean an acculturated Brooklyn Italian guy who's in Marin County, California, San Francisco. I'm talking about still the street tongue and really loud and really heavy duty and incredible. I tried to buy a car from a couple of years ago in a car dealer. That's where we had originally met. He reminded me. I didn't know. But his parents are such wonderful people. You know, I can't explain it. When you meet people, all social barriers drop. It doesn't mean anything. You know, remember, I have written 5 best-selling books on the New York Times bestseller list. Don't you ever forget that. You can underestimate me all you want, but believe me, millions of people don't. Just remember who you're talking to. So I don't play the highbrow number with people, although I believe me, I can do it. I just don't do it. I'd rather not. I'm very much like McChrystal in one regard. He said he'd rather get dental work than go to another dinner with a French diplomat. You know what I'm saying? And that's why I'd rather be alone with a takeout on the boat with the, you know. So that's the story. I mean, you know, it was a lot of fun for me to contact real people who willing. I mean, the guy was willing to stand up and get into a brawl for me. I didn't want him to do it. But yeah, I got to tell you one little side note about the slob on the sailboat. This guy was about 65 years old, white hair, a gut on him. The kind of ugly fat slob with the gut hanging over the, I don't know how he even had a sailboat. The guy looks like he should drive a Lexus in Los Angeles. And he had an old sailboat. Mine was worth 10 grand. He had a piece of junk, about 32 feet long. But anyway, the point is, after this whole incident, another boat pulls up. And this slob walks down the dock and says to the guy, do this or do that, I can help you. And the guy's wife says to him, he knew what he was doing before you showed up. In other words, shut your mouth and get away. We don't need you. He was a troublemaker. He was looking for trouble. That type. And, you know, I felt it was a godsend. I did something good yesterday for the first time in years. I felt God rewarded me immediately. In a little way. I think God watches us. I really do. I know sometimes I go in and out of this thing. I know it sounds very childish to tell you this. It's little stuff. And he says, oh, if something went bad, God didn't like you. Yeah, God shouldn't like me. I'm no good. I'm no good like the rest of you. We're all no good. We're all born bad and we get worse.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Normally, I don't usually take a long vacation in there. I take a week. But you know, this year, I am so burned out. I'm so tired from it all. I'm thinking of just, I don't know where to go, though. I maybe Fiji again. Taviuni, I'm thinking of going back. Because I was there from 69 off and on for many, many years collecting plants. Long before Fiji became a real tourist destination. I was there when it was still a colony. God, I'm getting old. I can't believe it. I got off the ship, the Oriana, in June of 1969, I think, or July, September of 1969, and Fiji was still a colony. I can't believe it. It was the last year of being a British colony. What year is this? It's like, what is going on, Ichabod Crane? My God, that's like a lifetime, you know? By cracky, I'm like Methuselah here on the radio. I don't know if I want to go back because I think that there won't even be a country I'll recognize at all down there. And it's, you know, it's a big tourist destination now. It's like a Hawaii, like a would-be Hawaii. They take brave, bold, muscular men who should be hunting and have them serve drinks to weaklings from America and Australia. There's something that nauseates me about that, to see muscular Fijian men with a flower in their hair serving a drink to a weakling from Australia or America. Sitting with a pasty body by the pool. Something about it in me rebels against it. I don't know what it is. I mean, I'm a Westerner. I understand. I'm not a big muscular guy. But I don't know. There's something in me. There's still a part of me that doesn't like it. When they say, you know, Nisan Bula, and the guy crouches down to give some warthog a Mai Tai. There's something wrong with that picture. It's like white mischief to me. Oh, boy, oh, boy. That's the problem with having a kaleidoscopic mind. That's the problem. It's also the problem with being a logical mind. See, the problem with Western civilization is this, is that when you have reason, there's always a counterpoint to your reason. So people who don't have reason will always win. And that's why we're losing, because the radical Islamists don't have reason. They say, this is the way. Anyone who disagrees with it is an infidel. You're going to die. We say, won't you reason with us? They don't even know what you're talking about because there's no reason in their thought structure. And that's why we're going to lose unless we become more unreasonable than them. Iran is the nest, is the spider's nest behind it all. Everybody knows that. But it won't happen. I'm only a talk show host, so it doesn't matter anyway. So that's why I say it's time to go away. Some days I get up, you know what I want to do? I want to leave radio, disappear, change my look at the news, and say, well, you know, when I'm an old man, if someone comes here with a headscarf and a scimitar, I'll know that we lost. And when I'm a very old man, if someone doesn't come here with a headscarf and a scimitar, I'll know that we won. Until that time, leave me alone. I'd rather drink Yangona, you know, and beer, and that's the end of the story. Go out like Robinson Crusoe. Not worry about going to a dermatologist every time I get a scab on my head. I never heard of anything like the society I live in. Oh, look at that. I was in the sun. I got a scab. They cut you open on the head because you got a little scab. Everything you're supposed to go to the doctor for. There's a lot to be said for just getting old and dying, you know, also. I could see why a lot of the old-timers went out that way. They did. They didn't like the whole scene. You're going to get butchered in the end. All they do is cut you up and leave you like a hamburger and take out a couple of hundred grand from your family from the 20% that your insurance doesn't cover. I went to the doctor the other day. He says to me, what kind of country do we live in that Russians come here? They have to only wait 5 years. He said they get gold-plated medical treatment, unlike anything Uncle Joe Stalin promised them in Russia. He said, while union workers in this country, average workers in this country, can't get their teeth fixed, can't get a prescription drug filled. He said, what kind of country do we live in? I won't tell you the doctor's name, but he's an American. I said, welcome to America where the streets are paved with yolds. Oh, Anthony, next topic, please.
Cook Islands. That's where you want to go.
I was in the Cook Islands. I was in Palmyra. I was in the Cook Islands. So how long has it been since you've been there?
I go there. I try to go there every year.
Where do you go? What part of the Cooks do you go to?
I go to Aitutaki. Atu is where my wife's from. There's only about 400 people on that island. And Tonga.
Have you ever been to Palmyra?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. Well, look, they're pretty remote, those islands. People don't even know what remote is until they've set foot in one of those atolls where there's an entire community of individuals who have been living there since God created the earth. It's hard to imagine what it's like. Even though they're westernized to a certain extent, you can still get the vibe off the ancient, can't you?
Yeah. Oh, the caves there in Atu, it's incredible there. I would strongly suggest revisiting that place again because it hasn't changed much.
Yeah, well, you know, in Rarotonga, when I first went there, what's the dance that they do where the women shake their bodies and they go, what's that called?
Asian. My wife's an actual dancer, too.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? An amazing culture. So where did you meet your wife?
I met her here in Marin County, unfortunately.
I'm sorry, that's funny. What, she came as a dancer and you stole her heart?
No, it's a longer story than that. I'm sure you don't have time for it all, but we hooked up in a great way, and I just couldn't let her go.
Isn't that beautiful? That's a beautiful story. So do you have children yet?
Yeah, I have one named Rockanui and another one Giovanni. I just had another second son.
And where are you raising the children, Anthony?
I'm doing my best to raise them in Marin County. I've been here my whole life. I went through all the Democratic stuff. My father's very politically active here. He was a Marin County supervisor for 25 years and made a lot of big changes for the right reasons here. But I'll tell you, man, it's hard to survive over here with all these bumper stickers.
It's frightening. No, the county has been completely mentally polluted by Barbara Boxer. She has warped the mind of Marin County. This used to be a Republican-conservative stronghold, this county across the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. But since she came out, she spread the virus of liberalism, and it's now metastasized.
You know, there was a time where...
Well, wait, hold on a minute. But raising the children, this is a very important question, Anthony. Let me go into it with you because it applies to all people who love America, across America, young people who are having children who are bewildered. You can raise a child the right way, even in a liberal community, and you don't have to become fanatically religious to do so either. There is a way to do it. You know, you can survive, you can swim with these comedians and still turn out a child of substance.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have. And I plan on raising them the right way.
Well, look, let me explain two things from my point of view. And I'm certainly you're a strong man, obviously, who's going to do it your way. If you teach your children the culture of your own culture, it's probably a European-American heritage, I would assume, and then the culture of your wife of Asian, I'm sorry, of Pacific Islander, you teach them the essence of what that means, borders, language, and culture, and how those people survive for thousands of years on their own, with their own language, with their own culture, with their own borders, meaning the borders of their island, and how that applies to America, your child will find his way or her way in this country at the end of the day.
The reasons that we make sure we all go back there, that the, so they're linked to that culture as well. I think it's important.
Well, you're a lucky man. Obviously, you have a strength of mind, and that's why your children will turn out fine. Now, you're going to send them where, to Redwood High School?
Well, I went to Drake, so, you know, they'll probably end up at Drake.
Guess what? You can send your child to a very liberal school where drugs are rampant, and they could come out without having used drugs and still have a spine. It can be done. You mustn't let the liberal virus drive the good people out. You mustn't. You must try to save every, just save your own child, and by doing so, you may save the school and the county. Thanks for the call. I don't think I'm going to go to the Cook Islands. Do we have any Cook Island music? That is such great music. When I first heard it in 1970 in the islands, it was like, with the drums, they use sticks on wood. God, I'd love to dig some of that music up. I have some old tapes that are so great. I got to dig them out of the archives. Anybody have Cook Island music they could play in the background, or Tahitian, the old Tahitian music? What am I talking about? You don't even know what I'm talking about. Hey, I don't have to do politics. I could just do radio. I can tell you story. You want me to tell stories about the South Pacific plant collecting circa 1969 through X? Why, I can remember. I've been through hurricanes, tornadoes, and typhoons. I was on a ship between Tahiti and Fiji in a Force 10 storm. We thought that steel ship would go down, but by cracky, she didn't. It's 100% true. Did I tell you about the German captain on that ship? I was simply a lecturer. For a long while, you see, I got free passage on cruise ships as a lecturer because I had been an anthropologist. I had some good slides. Color slides, lantern slides. Sounds like Charles Darwin. No one uses them anymore. I mean, taken with the old Nikon F with an actual light meter, some of the most beautiful pictures I've ever seen I took. I mean, of the islands, because I really knew lighting and I had a great camera, the old Nikon F with the light meter. And so anyway, the long and short of it is, so I talked my way into various cruise lines and they would offer us a free first class passage, and then I'd get a cabin for the children. Now, they were very young and I'd have to take them out of school, but I believe that the children would learn more in a month away at sea and visiting the islands and seeing, you know, people of means that they'd meet on the ships when ship travel still had a little dignity, than they would sitting in a school on a wooden chair listening to a stuffy lecture about the wonders of hedonism.
Savage.
Mark Masters, Talk Radio Network, and Michael Savage are partners. We've been in business together since when? 2000? Oh, I forgot to tell you, the Force 10 storm. That's right. Let me tell you, it's a true story, because this was one of the most frightening moments of my life, because my family was on the ship. I started to tell you the story in the last hour. So as I was saying, when I was a younger guy, because I had been in the islands as an anthropologist, ethnobotanist, and I had great slides taken with my Nikon F, with the light meter days. I mean, those were the days of real photography. I'm not saying you can't do it with digital. You can, because I have a digital camera, which I'm very fond of. I really don't know how to compare the two, because I'm very happy with the digital pictures in some way. But the day of holding the light meter and stepping back, and that was another story with the clicking the lenses on the Nikon F, which you got out of Hong Kong at a discount through a friend. I mean, they were exciting days of taking pictures, and you took slides in those days. Slides, like a hello, lantern slides, as I said, Charles Darwin. You know, does anyone do slides anymore? I don't think so. I don't think anyone does a slide. But the quality of the depth of the picture was phenomenal. I have some pictures, for example, of kids, and these were mixed-race kids, incidentally, in the Cook Islands in the circa 1970 or 71. Laughing on a roadside as I went by and started to talk to them. right after a light rainstorm. So anyway, because I had great slides, I went to the cruise lines because I was always in love with big ships. I remember when I was a kid in New York, because I was landlocked and grew up in a family that didn't know from boating, from a locks. I used to drive on the West Side Highway when I first got my car in New York, if you know what the West Side Highway is, and the great cruise ships of the world would line up on the Hudson River piers, and I would drive by. They were the most beautiful visions I had ever seen. Each ship was filled with the promise of a thousand lifetimes to me. I don't know what drew me to the sea in that way, but I had said to myself that when I got older, whatever I did, I had to go to sea in some way or another. Now, I didn't go in the Navy. Fate did not take me in the Navy. Perhaps that would have been another life and a great life unto itself. But as I say, so I went to the islands. I took these great pictures. And then, as I had children and I still wanted to get out there and didn't have the money to do so, I marketed myself in the proper manner, went to the cruise lines, and I said, well, I could lecture your passengers on the islands and this and that, which was true, and have great pictures and showed it to boom, boom, boom. So I got the first-class cabin for the two of us and one for the kids. So I took the kids out of school very often during vacations, and it was a question. Should you take your kids out of school for a month at a time? And they'd fall behind in lessons. And I remember, I hope my son's not listening, and I would say, now, look, son, I'm taking you out of school for a month. This is a great privilege to go on a ship. You're going to have to take your lessons with you. We're going to do the lessons on the ship, and you're going to keep a journal. Sure, Dad. Now, remember, because you have an opportunity to learn from far. Yeah, Dad, sure. Well, needless to say, 3 days out, the journal was still blank. The pages were blank, and the school books were still sitting on the shelf, and the kids were wheeling around the deck of the ship, bothering all of the old people who hated children. They were the only children on the ship in some cases, because who else had a child on a ship in those days in the month of, let's say, October or November? Nobody. And so, therefore, we would be at sea. Now, where was I? Okay, so one of the ships that we got on was not a big ocean liner, a 35,000-ton, let's say, Royal Viking ship. They were magnificent. I remember once I got on a ship called, oh, I don't know what it was called, my God, but it was a small ship with a very small draft that could get into shallow waters like in the Antarctic because it was made for Antarctic cruising. Okay, so shallow bottom ship between Tahiti and Fiji, two cabins. It didn't have many passengers. It was a 5,000-ton ship. That's pretty small when the average cruise ship then was, a big ship was 35,000 tons. Today they're 100,000 tons, 100 and a quarter. They're monsters. They're hotels with propellers. For better or for worse, I don't particularly like that size ship for myself. If you do, God bless you. So I'm on a 5,000-ton boat, shallow keel, very shallow keel, and we leave Fiji, and we're supposed to be out there back and forth for about 20 days. You know, Fiji, island hopping to Tahiti, around a Christmas time, New Year's time. Well, we get into a hurricane. Now, you got a shallow bottom ship, 5,000 tons, and this ship is rolling. In the middle of the night, I hear a pounding. They put me as a lecturer in the front of the ship in the forward bow cabin, not exactly the best steel hull, and I'm hearing banging like someone's hitting the hull with a sledgehammer. So I wake up, and I said, something is wrong. Why is this ship sounding like this? I get up. I go in the passageways. Nobody is awake. But being a survival type, I knew something was wrong. I throw on a windbreak. I climb up to the bridge, and there is the German captain, who is normally as nattily dressed as you would expect of a sea captain. He is unshaven. He is in an undershirt, and his eyes are in a state of absolute, I don't know how to put it. They weren't in a state of panic, but they were locked. They were locked onto another place at another time. And he looks at me as though I'm not there. He looks right through me. His hands are locked on the wheel. And he's looking. I can't explain it. It wasn't a state of panic. I don't know how to describe it. I almost don't have the words for it, and I'm pretty good with words. But his eyes were looking somewhere away. Maybe you say like a soldier, where they say they have the 1,000-yard look. That's what he had. And he had gone a little nuts from the pressure. And he said to me, lecturer. He wasn't even calling me by the name anymore. Lecturer, all the time, Fiji, Tahiti, Tahiti, Fiji. Lecturer, Fiji, Tahiti, Tahiti, Fiji, lecturer. You know, it's like he had gone nuts already. Anyway, the long and short of it was we went into a terrible, terrible gale. I don't know what they call it, a storm down there. It's not called a typhoon in that area, not a monsoon. Whatever it was very rough and very bad. And I feared the ship would go down. And I became kind of disenamored of taking my children on long trips on small ships after that, to be honest with you. So be that as it may, here I am in front of a microphone, nice and safe, landlocked, sitting in a dry place, watching the world go round. Now, where was I? Oh, so I was going to ask you, if you came from a family that took you away on long trips, did it affect you positively in the long run or negatively? Now, this is interesting because here's the interesting twist to this whole thing. It was actually a liberal thought in those days that if you took your child out of school for a long trip and they were exposed to the world, they would get more out of that long exposure than they would from sitting in a classroom. That was actually a liberal philosophy, which I went along with and ascribed to. And it turned out, what's on your mind?
Hey, I'm Martin, and I'm a chef now. I was in the Army. I always liked loud noises. I used to shoot with a shotgun when I was 12 years old. Now I'm in the
so
Army.
You like loud noises, but what about when you're a chef?
Well, I'm a chef. Well, my point was, the reason why you want it quiet is you want a certain ambiance to enjoy good food. If it's good, it's good.
Well, I cannot eat around noise. I can't even eat around conversation.
Yeah, but you want it quiet to enjoy. You want a certain level of quiet.
Well, let's talk about this as human beings. When you eat, you put the fork into food. We're not talking about just taking in calories. We're talking about dining, okay, as opposed to eating. You're eating a sandwich, you could eat it on a subway car, right? But when you're actually trying to taste the food, experience the food, savor the food or the wine, don't you need to kind of have a cerebral reaction as well as just a gustatorial reaction?
What?
That's all.
Sorry.
All right, thanks for the call. I already had too many big words. Sorry, cerebral gustatory. This is the problem. It's like opera. In other words, you go too high and you lose the audience. You go too low and you're Michael Jackson with the glove and the casket. That's all.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Now listen to the best from June of this year.
What's the matter with you?
I guess I just can't take it, sir.
What did you say?
It's my nerves, sir. I just can't stand the Shelley anymore.
Your nerves? Well, hell, you're just a coward. We have a yellow bastard sitting here crying in front of these brave men who've been wounded in battle. Shut up! Don't admit this yellow bastard. Nothing wrong with him. We won't have... We're afraid to fight, stinking up this place of honor. You're going back to the front, my friend. You may get shot. You may get killed. But you're going up to the fighting. Either that or I'm going to stand you up in front of a firing squad. I ought to see to myself, bastard. Get him out of here. Send him up to the front. You hear me? You coward? I won't have cowards in my army.
So the community organizer today fired a great war hero, a true warrior, a true warrior. The man who was defending America was dismissed by the man who was stapling flyers to telephone poles over the years. The thin-skinned president who was never fired a Daisy BB gun apparently has fired General McChrystal. We have had a civilian coup of the United States military. All of the true warriors are being drummed out of the Corps, and all of the political officers are being left into the Corps. And that is because, let us put it to you this way, there are things afoot that are not being spoken about. General Stanley McChrystal is being persecuted for telling the truth. and the vermin in the media have been sharpening their knives all day long, eagerly anticipating the kill. The brain-dead apparatchik on MSNBC, Contessa Brewer, a ditz of the highest order, had the nerve to call General McChrystal and his aides a posse. And Andy Mitchell, you know her as Andrea Mitchell, we call her Andy Mitchell around here, declared that the general crossed the line of insubordination. And Joe Haystack, the congressman that Obama bribed, said McChrystal broke military code. And John McShane joined Lieberman to stab McChrystal in the back. John McCain joined Lindsey Graham, that strange creature from South Carolina, and Joe Lieberman, the whiner from Connecticut, and said McChrystal should be removed. And so it was the night of the short knives by the dwarfs in the political military establishment. I played for you today on the Savage Nation the speech by General MacArthur from 1951. He says, old soldiers never die, they just fade away. General MacArthur was relieved of command by Truman for criticizing Truman back in 1950. Remember, General MacArthur was one of the great ones. He conceived and executed a great amphibious assault at Incheon in Korea, for which he was hailed as a hero. 7 months later, Truman fired him for making public statements that contradicted the official policies of the U.S. government, especially with regard to Truman's order to restrict military interaction with the media. And so it's happened before. What's amazing to me and what's strangely difficult to understand is how a man of McChrystal's mindset, a man who runs 7 miles a day, a man who takes one meal a day, a true Spartan warrior, a fourth-generation military man, how he would permit a lice-ridden vermin from Rolling Stone even near him, how he would admit a fetid drug addict from Rolling Stone to even interview him is beyond my comprehension. This is a product of the breakdown in the aid category. But make no mistake about it. We had a civilian coup today where the thin-skinned community organizer fired the real general to replace him with somebody who will knuckle under to the community organizer's staple gun. Remember, McChrystal is a real soldier. He graduated from West Point. He actually served in an Army Special Ops team in the first Gulf War, as opposed to the fakers who put a knife in our boy's back in the Marines and in the Army. He was the head of the team that killed Zarqawi. He has gone on many night missions, unheard of for generals. The man loves combat, went on night missions in Iraq, went on night missions while Obama was creeping around the nights of Chicago planning his coup. And all he said was a few objectionable things. I thought free speech was permitted in the United States of America. But I guess the old thin-skinned president, in between golf games, took offense at it. He criticized Biden, criticized Obama's handling of the war, criticized Hillary Clinton, and it's the soldier who gets fired. The White House has betrayed the troops time and time again. Obama betrayed the Navy SEALs. Obama betrayed Lieutenant Behenna. And now Obama's betrayed the leader of our forces in Afghanistan in the middle of a Kandahar offensive. This is Obama's way of undermining our military efforts overseas. He wants them out of there. And so he's taken out the one man who could save the war effort. What has occurred today is a civilian coup of the military. And because of it, our troops will pay the price of blood. 1-800-449-8255. How do you feel about General McChrystal being dismissed by the community organizer? And when I play you some of the sound bites, you're actually not going to believe what you're about to hear on the Savage Nation. You're not going to believe what you're about to hear. Stupid chicks on MSNBC, more snotty nonsense by chicks, calling General McChrystal and his aides a posse. Clip four, please.
Were you surprised at the level of access that your reporter, Michael Hastings, was able to get to General McChrystal and to his posse?
Stop right here. That's one of the stupidest women crawling the gutters of Manhattan, Contessa Brewer of MSNBC. That's the kind of chick talk you'd expect on The View. That's some kind of chick talk you'd expect from Whoopi Goldberg. It's unbelievable. Now, if you were the enemy, the hardened Muslim enemy, would you be afraid of an America where the media is run by slutty chicks on television whose biggest problem is how to meet a man or what kind of shoes to buy? when they take out the warriors and they let the chattering classes take over? Would you be afraid of America today when the number one general is dismissed by a community organizer who never fired anything but a Daisy BB gun? Excuse me, but a staple gun? Sorry, I was mistaken in that. I'm pretty sure Obama's never been allowed to touch a BB gun in his life. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Hawaii, Steve, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. As a former captain in the Marine Corps during Vietnam, I've been listening to this controversy all morning on talk radio, and I hear a lot of outraged people calling in talking about this oath, this famous oath that people have to give in the military to protect their commandant, to be a bow down in front of this dictator commandant. Well, I don't remember ever taking that oath, sir. When I took my oath, it was to defend the Constitution of the United States against foreign and domestic enemies, protect the people of this country. And to me, we have a domestic enemy, this administration.
I agree with you 100%, but remember, McChrystal was actually quite mild in his commentary about Biden and about Obama. He never really said very much. The fact of the matter is Obama does not want McChrystal there at all because McChrystal's the real McCoy, and it is said that that Obama is very uncomfortable in a room full of real warriors. Did you read that?
Absolutely.
In other words, when Obama the faker, when Obama the imposter, when Obama the strange one is in a room with real warriors, they say he gets very uncomfortable because he knows he doesn't belong there. The fact of the matter is there is no such rule, written or unwritten, where a general is supposed to be a martinet. And what's strange to me, Captain, is this. The phony liberals who said that during Hitler's period, if only the generals had stood up to Hitler and said something, the Holocaust could have been prevented. And now we have a general standing up and saying the most mild of things about this thin-skinned community organizing, Marxist, backstabbing, anti-American, and all of a sudden he's fired and they say, good for Obama. Good for Obama. This is a very big topic, a giant topic. It's the Savage Nation. If you've got a comment to make on this, the phone number is 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Let's go to Texas. Randy, you're up on the Savage Nation. Your opinion, please.
Michael, I believe that McChrystal did this on purpose. I believe it was a setup to expose Obama, to make the American people realize what's going on. There's no other way to do it. Nobody else could ever come up with a scheme like this, and now we all know, and you can talk about it.
Well, wait a minute. Talk about what? What are we talking about? We're talking about a thin-skinned community organizer of unknown origins who fires a war leader during a major offensive in Kandahar. What is it we're talking about? What actually are we talking about?
We are
that
losing.
Somebody dared say one word about this thin-skinned dictator and he gets fired? This is the America that the liberals want to live in?
We're losing the war in Afghanistan. The only way to expose this to the American people and get people outraged is for McChrystal to come out and do this and get the people on and against what's going on in the Obama administration, period.
Well, you know, McChrystal is a fourth-generation military man and a West Point graduate. You know that. No, you didn't know that. This is the real McCoy. You're dealing with a real Spartan warrior here. This is the real McCoy. Let me repeat it again. While the folks at MSNBC who were celebrating his removal were crawling the streets of New York at night looking for sex, he was on night missions in Iraq looking for our mortal enemies. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. Now listen to the best from June of this year.
I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down. So many times
the community organizer is allegedly fired General McChrystal on the eve of a major offensive of Kandahar. And we can talk about this for the next few days, and we will. But I'll bet that there are a lot of troops out there now thinking that if they call up Rolling Stone and tell them Obama is incompetent, they could also get a ticket home. You know, I mean, that's for sure. All they got to do is call up Rolling Stone, and there it is, a ticket home. The fact of the matter is the morale is finished now. And that's because the leadership is not there. Because the commander-in-chief is not a commander, and he's not in chief. What's mostly killing morale in the U.S. armed forces is, along with a hopeless assignment in Afghanistan to begin with, is the doctrine of counterinsurgency, which makes our men fight with one hand constantly tied behind their backs. Either we are at war and want to defeat and squash the radical Muslim enemy, and we do it the way we know how with heavy weapons, and we get the hell out of there in plain English. Have you ever believed you'd wake up one day to the most powerful military on earth making men fight in hand-to-hand combat, and they tell them don't fire a gun unless you're sure you're not going to kill anybody? Would you believe it? We have weapons that can annihilate all of Afghanistan. It can be disappeared and turned into atoms. You don't want to do that. Crippled nation. Crippled on every level. And the president, Obama, is really a symptom. He's not the cause of all of this. He's a symptom of a crippled nation. A degenerate, destroyed, corrupt nation. Immoral, corrupt, and crippled from top to bottom. I am an amateur student of history. I know what happened to Rome. I know that after 50 years of bad dictators who could not rule the country, they were corrupt, they were incompetent, Rome collapsed, and the Visigoths invaded Rome, and they divided up the spoils, they broke the nation. If you think that can't happen here, you're mistaken, because the Visigoths are here. Make no mistake about it. They're coming over the border every day. They're the, well, let me stop right here. I'm in enough trouble as it is. The Visigoths are here. And the enemies of your freedom are here. Half of them are congressmen or senators. They're working for foreign powers, in my opinion. And I don't give a damn who tells me I'm wrong, because I know I'm right. They're traitors. And that's why McChrystal, for the mild statements he made, mild statements, a few mild statements, that's why the thin-skinned one got rid of him. Because he's a little petty martinet. He can't stand any criticism, because he's a weak man and he knows it. Michael, San Diego, your opinion. Go ahead, please. You're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael again. I spoke to you last week for an hour and 15 minutes. Thank you for having me again. I want to say my hat's off to McChrystal. My hat's off to anyone that spits in the face of tyranny. Anyone that speaks the truth. Anyone that takes the light and shines it on what was the darkness of all these deeds that these people do. Okay, that people don't know about.
Michael, what do you think would happen if you were a fourth-generation military man, a West Point graduate, a Spartan warrior who actually went out on night missions in Iraq when he didn't have to? He could have sat in his behind like the rest of the fake generals do. And then you wake up and you see these cowards, these communists, these pacifists, these degenerates from Harvard running the military. What would you do?
Well, let me tell you something. My people have been here since 1690 on one side of my family, and they fought in every war. And I woke up this morning, and I realized that everything they fought for, okay, was being swept away in a wave of tyranny. Okay? And what
did you hear? Did you hear the latest rumor of what the thin-skinned one is going to do? The thin-skinned one is gonna allegedly grant an executive order granting amnesty to the illegal aliens with the sweep of a pen, telling the American people to drop dead.
Well, and yes, and telling the American people they're not Americans anymore. They're part of the North American Union. Let me tell you something. If there's any people out there with any gumption left, okay, if you have the spirit of Audie Murphy, okay, Robert E. Lee, the greatest generals that ever were, Washington, if you're out there anywheres, you better stand up and you better get ready to fight against what's coming, okay? Because it's coming.
Well, I'll tell you what's bothering me more than the McChrystal resignation itself, which is what I heard yesterday from Secretary Robert Gates. I don't know if you heard my show, but I was talking about how astonishing it is the defense secretary, when asked about Iran, said, I don't even want to go there about containing Iran. This is the same defense secretary who, after the Fort Hood massacre, said, I don't even want to go there when asked if it was an act of Islamic terror. And I said to myself, something is wrong with this picture. It's as though the top leadership has capitulated to the enemy already. That's what worries me. Then the next day we read that McChrystal is out. I think that something much bigger than this is underneath the surface. And I am terrified that if they eliminate the Marine Corps, which is what they're alleging they're going to do, because it's the last bastion of pure warriors, we're going to have Obama's private army.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of the Savage Nation.
Mark Masters, who has syndicated me for over 9 years now. And we're going to be, as Harry Truman said, give him you-know-what for the next couple of years. That's our job. Our job is to be watchdogs, not to be lapdogs, Mark. And I want to thank you for giving me total and absolute freedom to do so. That's the point I'm trying to make. I wouldn't have lasted a week with another syndicator. I could never have sat down after a show and been deconstructed where they say, well, you said this, tomorrow don't say that. That's it would have been the end of it for me. I've had total freedom. I need total freedom to function. And Mark, I want to thank you again. I'm glad we're going to be working together. And I know the American people, who particularly the millions and millions of people who listen to this show, are going to breathe a sigh of relief that we have this year to look forward to together. I'm a little loopy today. I've been trying not to tell you the story, but, you know, since radio to me is a bit of a confessional and I swore to Mrs. Savage I wouldn't tell the story, I can't tell you why I'm a little loopy today. If she would call and say you can, I will do it. Well, wait a minute. Is there a way around this? I'll have to think about it. Oh, big deal. It's not that big a story. So I went aground in the mud yesterday. I had to wait for the high tide for 6 hours. And the dogs got scared as night descended upon the bay and we were stranded. Ah, what the heck? What the heck if the Coast Guard came and couldn't do anything for us because the mud was so deep and we were so far in it? I was not piloting, incidentally. You want to see how many metaphors I can tell you about going aground? And I mean hard aground. Hello, this is Michael Savage. I'm hard aground somewhere in the vicinity of the Richmond Yacht Harbor. You know what had happened just before that? And there's so many metaphors to this story. Well, first of all, there's good and bad in everything. I don't know if you know what going hard aground means. If you hit a reef, you usually go down because the reef cuts the bottom of your boat open and you sink. If you're not watching what you're doing or you're not reading your charts right or your depth finder is off, you might go up on mud. And if you do and you go in at a low tide, you're going to wait 6 hours for a high tide to float you off that mud, which I had to do. It could have been much worse. I could have gone hard aground at high tide, which means I would still be there because there's no way off at high tide. But you know something? I'm an impatient guy. And I've heard the phrase, God, it was as boring as watching paint dry. No, sir. I've got something better for you for a new metaphor, but it's not so generally known that people would get it. It's as boring as waiting for the tide to come in, because that's what we had to do. Went aground at 3 o'clock, called the Coast Guard. They came out. They couldn't get within 100 yards of us. All I said was drop your anchor, put on your life jackets, and have a nice day. He said to me, the next high tide is at midnight. You should be able to float off at 10 o'clock tonight. I said, yeah. So from 3 o'clock to 10, the dogs couldn't make, and that's the part that bothered me the worst. I mean, we had food and water. It wasn't life-threatening. But the fact is the poor doggies got to me. Teddy was worried because he was up on the bow of the boat and looking, and he could smell the land. He could almost hear people. It wasn't that far away. And the poor boy, after 4 or 5 hours, he had to go. And I got to the point where my little finicky, everything has to be perfect boat, I said, Teddy, crap on the deck. Please, dump on the upholstery. Teddy, pee on the steering wheel. Whatever you got to do, I don't care, man. This is an emergency. Okay, let go of the anal retentive stuff, man. Do it. Dump on the sofa. He didn't do it, but the little one did. She listened. She overheard. And the teacup peed on the sofa, which I really don't care. But I got to tell you something. Any couple can go aground. It depends upon what the couple is made of as to whether how they get off that sandbar. And a lot happens in a few hours. And this is no heroic thing. I'm not putting the context of being adrift for 29 days in a lifeboat and killing a sea turtle and drinking each other's urine. You know, I'm not talking about that. In my little hothouse rose life, the life that I lead, the little constrained life that I lead, it was somewhat of a big deal to go aground because I'm a careful guy. I never make mistakes like this. My boat is my treasured possession. I'm also a very careful boater. But there's a little story coming. For about 1, 2, 5 minutes, I relaxed. I went below. I put on a pair of shorts. I don't wear shorts. I don't like shorts. I hadn't worn shorts since 1970, but it was a balmy day. I said, oh, look at this, Bermuda shorts. And I sat backwards up on the flybridge, and I lifted my legs up, and I wasn't even drinking. The next thing I know, nothing's happening. All right, these things happen. It was my mistake for not paying attention. Da, 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 da. I'm not blaming anybody because ultimately it's my boat and I'm the captain. So therefore, it's my responsibility. But the fact of the matter is we had to sit for 6 hours. And, you know, we didn't even go aground at low tide. We went aground an hour before low tide, which means that we had to wait an hour and watch the mud come up even higher. And then I went down in the dinghy and went around the boat, and this thing looked like it was in dry dock, sitting in the mud. I got to tell you, as a guy who's finicky about the maintenance of his craft, it didn't feel very good. And that's what it was. So it got dark, and there was nothing to do. And I couldn't run the generator because there was no water to cool it. So we had to sit in the dark and talk to the dogs. I couldn't sleep. I was agitated. And all I was doing was waiting for the water to come up. It's a very slow process. You can't rush God. God has his own little time frame. And as I've said to you many times, God sees the truth but waits. This had nothing to do with God. Or did it? Well, I think it did. It actually did. Because over the last few days, I turned my back on God over the last week. I had gotten cynical about God. I did. Now, normally I'm a God-fearing man. God is with me every second of the day, 24 hours a day. Doesn't mean I'm a haloed guy, not by any means. But I, you know when I'm doing the right thing and the wrong thing. And for the last week, I started to get cynical about religion and God and who needs it and who are they, and I can't stand them all. And you know what? The heck with it. I think I'll become a Hindu. And I think I'll get statues with arms on it just to shock the neighbors. I was reaching that point. Well, how do I know that God didn't speak to me in a quiet way and give me just a light slap on the wrist saying, go ahead, keep it up. Go ahead, we'll just put you aground in a little mud and let you float off in 6 hours, and then you'll have to go home in the dark without... Oh, by the way, your emergency radio will quit too, which it did. Can you believe this? This thousands of dollars radio that I'd like to strangle the guy who made me, sold it to me, because I wanted the cheap one. He sold me this piece of crap. I hated it from the day I got it. It died on me just when I needed it. So now I have to go home in the dark on the bay by line of sight, no radar, no chart plotter. And you know what? I did fine because I have very good night vision. But finding your harbor at night without radar and without any guidance is very interesting. It brings you back to a different part of yourself and actually opens you up to, just different feelings. And then when I got the boat in, I will tell you I had three vodkas straight in a row. And it didn't feel bad. As a matter of fact, it felt quite good. That third vodka, by the time the third vodka hit the brain center, which I aimed for, God, if only there was a little spot in your head you could open. See, if I were to talk to God when I get there and say, look, why don't you redesign us? Here's what I'd suggest. Put a little spout on the top of the head that you could put something in and you could just pour it right in on the brain. Why kill the other cells? You know what I mean? Anyway. By the time I hit the third vodka, and I was sitting on the deck looking at the boat, and she was so beautiful. I mean, I don't blame the boat. I blame me, okay? She was so good. This boat is so great. Right after the show, I got to run to the boat, and I got to open up the sea strainers, which is quite a job for me. And I got to take out she ran fine, cool. I purged the mud because I ran it slowly. I don't know what's in there. I just want to clean them up. This is a good boat. She was good to me. And I'm just telling you this story. So I'm a little loopy. Yeah, that's the reason I'm miscuing and some of my words are getting slightly a slur because it was a disturbing experience. And the dogs are a little today, you know, Teddy looks hurt. As a matter of fact, when I sat on the deck with the third drink, he gave me his hind. I mean, I don't mean he gave it to me to take. He put his behind towards me. He wasn't like, oh, happy, Dad, I'm happy. We're all happy. No, it wasn't like a cartoon. It wasn't the Donald Duck and Walt Disney, the ending of the cartoon. Teddy turned his behind towards me as if to say, look what's under my tail. That's what you are, okay? I don't steer boats, right? I'm just a dog. I'm a couple of pounds. I trusted you, okay? And you went aground, okay? Look under my tail. That's who you are. You got it? And don't even talk to me, all right? Have a nice night. All I can think about in those, you know, to me it was a big deal because I'm impatient. 6 hours sitting on a mud bank waiting for the tide to come up is a very long time. I couldn't run a generator. I had no inverter, so I had no electricity. So there were no lights in the boat, and you had to just watch the light fall and it get dark. I'm not saying we were starving or in danger, but with the two little dogs on the boat, it became more real for me. I mean, I could wait it out, you know, and I had a head to use. They didn't. I tried everything. I said, Teddy, here's the sink. I put him in the sink. I said, pee. No. Here's the toilet. Watch, Daddy. Look how I do it. Stand up. No, he wouldn't do that. And I felt bad for the guy. I mean, you know, you start feeling bad for the dog. They're so housebroken, at least he is, that he wouldn't break rank with his own training and do anything. And I didn't want... I don't know what it is. I like that bothered me more than anything, other than the embarrassment.
Yeah, I'm an ex-commercial fisherman, and once we're stuck for about 20 hours high and dry in a 32-foot commercial gill netter up in Alaska.
Well, I feel better that you as a professional can go aground. I was told by a man rowed by late at night, and he didn't know if the boat was abandoned, and I talked to him on the rail, and he said, I figured you were stuck on the mud. He said, look, someone once said if you're easily embarrassed, you know, don't go into boating. Because apparently this happens to a lot of people, Sal. How did it happen to you, though, as a professional with all that equipment?
Well, we're fishing the side of a river. It's called the Egigic River in Bristol Bay. And basically there's a lot of sandbars. You know, you're using your... There's not a lot of equipment because the river's running so fast. You got to remember, low tide there may be minus 4 or 5 feet. High tide may be 22 feet. So instead,
oh, my God. Oh, wow. What a differential. So in other words, there are a lot of pockets at low tide of sandbars.
Right. So what happened was at that time, the high tide was like 19 and a half feet or something. And about a half hour after the tide turned, we got stuck. We got stuck on a sandbar. So
wait, you got stuck at high tide?
We got stuck an hour after less than an hour after the tide turned. The problem was the next high tide was only a 14-footer.
Oh, my God. So what did you do for those 20 hours?
Well, we sat there, we ate, we drank around for a while because, you know, like...
Well, I mean, you were able to get off the boat?
Yeah.
Oh, because you're on a river.
Yeah, we're in the river, so it was, like I said, it wasn't real soft mud.
Yeah, I wouldn't have mind walking to a 7-Eleven. Unfortunately, we were sort of in a bay, and I couldn't go on land. I would love to have just abandoned the boat, but I didn't want to abandon it. So anyway, you know, apparently this is quite a common experience, Sal, so that's why I'm not ashamed to talk about it. And I learned a lot. Thanks for the call. I learned by trial by fire. Spokane, Washington. Tom, you're up on the Savage Nation.
Hello, Mr. Savage. Pleasure to talk to you because you're so intelligent. I'm not even close. But anyway, I worked on the water for 22 years and heavy marine construction, worked in the Bay Area for 9.5 years and have been aground myself. But the next time that you realize that you go aground immediately, you have twin screws, right?
Okay. Yep. Hold on. We'll come back to this because I tried everything I would do with a car stuck on ice, and all it did was dig it in deeper like a plane crashing in the sand. I'll be back.
Savage.
I drive into the city, go to this Chinese restaurant. Now, for one, the parking is enough to give you indigestion if you get there, and it's terrible, just awful. That already gives you indigestion. There's no point in going. So I get there. I've eaten there for 20 years, and they still mistreat us. It's just that I don't know if it's a nature of the business. They don't like me. It's racism. I don't know what it is. I can't tell. I get in there. I order a number of dishes, and I'm meeting a friend, and they bring us immediately the pot stickers and the steamed dim sum within 5 minutes. I said, well, tonight's going to be different. Now I'm 3 beers into the meal and there are no dishes. And everyone who came in after me is eating. 8 times I get up, where's the food? Then they bring it out and the rice is at the end. And it was a mess. Okay, a nightmare. I'm never going there again. But wait, the best is yet to come. My friend John, who's a philosophy professor, shows up a few minutes late. And he comes and he says, I had to park in a driveway around the corner. I hope I don't get a ticket. So right away, that's double anxiety. I don't blame him. There's no parking. Then he runs out 5 minutes later. And he puts a note in his windshield, which says, please don't tell me. Call my cell phone number if you want me to move. Sure enough, in the middle of the meal, ring, ring. Oh, I'll be right out. I'll be right out. So I go out with him because John is a philosophy professor and he's not street smart. I just had an instinct. I better be with him. Sure enough, there's a crazed Russian in the street. He had parked not only in the guy's driveway, but right against the guy's bumper, and the Russian is insanely mad, screaming and yelling, "You have no brains! No brains! No brains! No brains! Stupid, stupid, stupid brain! No brains! What, you have no brains? Why are you parking my car?" And he's crazy. He's livid. Now, I know how to defuse street situations, and John, the philosophy professor, doesn't know anything about this kind of interchange. Everyone has their strengths and weaknesses. I'm trying to calm things down. I had had four beers already. So I said to him, "Look, tell you what, just calm down. You have no brains!" No, and he's screaming and yelling the Russian, "No brains, stupid!" And he's in everyone's face. So I said, this could escalate, turn very bad. You know, guns, knives, you don't know what's going to... Crazy relatives from the Ukraine could come out with tattoos from jail. You don't know where this is going to go. I'm trying to defuse it. So I'm saying to my friend, "Look, back the car up." I said, "If there's any damage, I will pay you." I figured money talks, right? I wasn't saying it was anyone's fault. "No brains. I don't care. Damage. No brains. No brains." And he's on and on with the no brains. I said, "Look, my friend is a philosophy professor. I don't care. No brains. Why on my car?" So I said, "John, back the car up." John backs the car up, and there's no damage whatsoever. So the Russian gets down on his knees. He says, "No brains, stupid! No brains anyway! I don't care, damage, no damage, stupid, no brains!" So I said, "Look, is there damage? If there's damage, I'll pay." "No brains, stupid! Stupid man!" I said, "Look, is there damage?" And I'm saying, "John, get in the car and get out of here. I'm going to take care of it. Go." And John doesn't go. John sits there and starts in with the guy, "I want to see you smile." I said, "Oh, my God." Now, the worst nightmare, you're telling an enraged Russian to smile? What does he think? This is a textbook in Marin County? He wants to see a smile out of an enraged Russian? He parked on his bumper? You know what that's like? That's like pulling out your private part and pressing it against his wife's jeans in the street. You know what I'm saying? Exactly right. "All right, look, I understand people expose themselves when drunk in Russia, but you don't touch wife's pants with private part. You get killed for this." It was the equivalent of, what are you parking against the guy's bumper for? It's bad enough to be in the driveway, but if you're going to park there, you don't put it on the guy's bumper. It was like a new car and little, and it looks like the guy worked all his life for his first new car. And to him, this was like a sexual encounter. It's like, "All right, in my country, I know they get drunk and they pull it out, but they don't touch wife's pants." It was like on that level of insanity, the guy parked against his car. So I said, "Get out of here." And he's out of the car telling the guy, "I want to see you smile." I figure a relative is going to come out and say, "What you say to my uncle? Smile? In Russia, the worst insult, tell him to smile when he's angry." I mean, to me, it looked like it was going to blow up into World War III. So I said to him, "Get in the car and get out of here." No, not here. So again, telling the guy that he didn't mean it and he wants him to smile. So I said to him, and the guy's screaming, "I don't understand America. American people, stupid. Stupid American people." So I said to him, I looked him in the eye and I said, "But you like America, don't you?" See, I knew how to turn the situation because I know in Russia a little bit about the Russian mind, which is that you can hate the person, but if you're a guest in another person's country, you don't hate the country because in his country you get killed for hating someone else's country or your own country. I mean, he knows from his own reversal that through history, if you say you hated Poland and there's a Polish man in the street drunk, he'll kill you. But you see, after they... I hate you, but I like Poland. It's a strange kind of Slavic sense of humor that you have to understand how to defuse these things. "His stupid friend, no brain. I hate Americans, stupid, don't understand them, but I love America." So it was like that kind of thing. Finally, it ended. So naturally, I'm never going to go back to that restaurant. That's all. You have to have been there. What I should have done is tape recorded this one. This would have been a beauty to have on tape recording.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Listen up. Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Now listen to the best from June of this year. It is Savage Nation, Kitten on the Keys. Today is dedicated to the 1920s jazz era for reasons you will soon discover. Play Broadway Rag. I like it better. It's a little too high-pitched for me. Don't worry, we'll get political, I guarantee. I'm warming up. All right. So we're warming you up. Step into Savage's Saloon. And we will begin. We're going to begin with a story out of the Miami Herald today that I couldn't stop reading. I went over and over it. Ponzi schemer Scott Rothstein gets 50-year sentence. Rothstein was convicted of running a $1.2 billion investment scam. The prosecutor asked for 40 years. The judge threw the book at him and gave him 50 years. It was a judge, James Cone, an Alabama native appointed by Bush, who was brought into Florida to give the disbarred lawyer more than what prosecutors requested for his crime as the mastermind of South Florida's biggest financial fraud. So he brought down not only his own family, but he brought down his 70-attorney law firm, Rothstein, Rosenfeld, and Adler. And you take a look at what this man did while he was making his ill-gotten gains. Held himself up as a wealthy, important man. Hung around with so-called society types. You know, the fake people in Palm Beach, the people easily duped by Madoff. He went to fancy restaurants, which he busted out. Hung around with politicians like Charlie Crist. Gave millions to charities, all on ill-gotten gains. Rothstein, born into a working-class Bronx, New York family, had fled to Morocco in a charter jet with $16 million. Last week, he wrote in a 12-page letter to the judge that he contemplated suicide but stopped himself because it would just be one final act of selfishness, blah, blah, blah. And so he comes back and he faces the music, and instead of getting 30 or 40 years, he gets 50 years. I kept staring at the picture of the wife and the mother. I couldn't stop looking at the women. I mean, the reason they were wrecked is that the gig, you know, the gig is up. Okay, it's over. All of the fancy, the manicure, the pedicure. I could have just seen these types. The manicure, the pedicure, the jet, the rose, the manicure, the pedicure. You know the type. And I just kept looking at it and looking at it and looking at it. Then this afternoon, I see a story in the New York Post. Underboss takes a courtroom snooze after son testifies against him. Legendary Columbo underboss John Sonny Francisi, once so feared that even Frank Sinatra kissed his ring, dozed off in court today while an FBI recording of his turncoat son was played at his trial. The son, in other words, was testifying against his father. Earlier in the day, the mob father and son came face-to-face in the Brooklyn courtroom where Francisi Jr. testified against the ailing mobster who was on trial for shaking down two strip joints in a Long Island pizzeria. In other words, the guy was at the end of his ropes, the old man, but the son turned him in. You hear this? The former underboss, who sat expressionless most of the time, pinched the fabric of his shirt as if to check the color. And so it's the whole story now. So I'm saying, what's going on in this world? Now, the end of the story is very interesting. A son, a gangster son, turns against the father. Almost unheard of. Incomprehensible. So I'm playing in 1920s music because this character, Scott Rothstein in Florida, reminds me very much of the character in The Great Gatsby, written by F. Scott Fitzgerald, the great character Meyer Wolfsheim, who fixed the World Series of 1919, which of course was based upon another Rothstein, Arnold Rothstein. Arnold the Brain Rothstein was a New York businessman and gambler who became a famous kingpin of organized crime, the Jewish Mafia. Rothstein was also widely reputed to have been behind baseball's Black Sox scandal, in which the 1919 World Series was fixed. He notoriously inspired several fictional characters based on his life, including Maya Wolfsheim in F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Great Gatsby. Now, just listen to the end of this entry on Arnold Rothstein for a minute. On November 5th, 1928, Arnold Rothstein was shot and mortally wounded while conducting some business affairs at Manhattan's Park Central Hotel. He died the next day at the Stuyvesant Polyclinic Hospital in Manhattan. The shooting was allegedly linked to a gambling event, right? He didn't want to pay the money he lost at the game, $320,000. He said the game was fixed. So they arranged a hit on him, and the hit was arranged to punish Rothstein for welshing on his debt. Gambler George the Hump McManus was arrested for the murder, but later acquitted for lack of evidence. Now listen to this. Rothstein, on his deathbed, refused to identify his killer, answering police inquiries with, quote, "You stick to your trade, I'll stick to mine," and me mutter did it. So, in other words, the point is that in those days, a gangster had honor. He went to his grave rather than rat someone out. Now we have gangster sons ratting them out. In my day, Jewish men like Einstein were held up as role models. Jonas Salk was held up like a role model. And I search my mind and I say, all I see are Madoffs, Rothsteins, Bonnie Franks, Rahm Emanuels. Where are the Jewish giants, I ask? You know, we're very hard on Muslim terrorists, aren't we? And we're careful to say that the terrorists, while they are Muslim, do not reflect necessarily on the religion of Islam. And I would caution you to understand that the Meyer Wolfsheim character, the Scott Rothstein, although they are Jewish in name, do not necessarily reflect on the religion of Judaism or the Jewish people. On the other hand, we also see that the Catholic Church is smeared by the enemies of the Catholic Church because of the scandal of the molestation of some priests. We don't say all of Catholicism is bad, do we? But there's something connecting all of this, in my thinking at least. And that is, where are the giants? Where are the Jewish giants? Where are the Catholic giants? Where are the Muslim giants? Where are the Buddhist giants? Where are the Hindu giants? I don't see any of them. And I ask myself, what's happened to my world, the world? What has happened to all of civilization? Where are the great people of our time? I don't see them. I don't know where they are. Where are the Einsteins? Where are the Jonas Salks? Where are the great discoveries? Where have they gone, and what happened to our societies and our civilizations? It doesn't mean there aren't wonderful people in various spheres of endeavors, and there aren't great creative people, but the giants seem to be missing. Where are they, and where did they go? How did we wind up with Rothstein instead of Einstein? That's what I want to know. Why do we have Madoff and Rothstein? Why? Where does this come from? How does this happen? And why are they doing it? How have they lost their bearings, and how have they lost their honor? Well, I don't have the answer necessarily. I guess I could write an encyclopedia about it. There is other news that I could talk about if you'd like. You want to answer that question, you can. Maybe you want to challenge me and say, well, Michael, here are the Muslim giants. Here's a Muslim who discovered the cure for polio. I guess I missed that in my reading. Or here's a Jewish giant for you, Michael, if you're looking for a role model. Here's a man by the name of X, Y, and Z who did Y. Here is a Catholic giant. You say Catholic, Italian, Catholic. The only one I could think of who I look up to, frankly, is Mr. Alito on the Supreme Court. He's a giant of a judge. He's a great prize to his, you know, to his people. You know what I'm saying? But I don't know where to turn with this. To be honest with you, maybe you want to talk with me about it. The Italian gangsters, the son turns on the father. It's unbelievable to me. This guy down in Florida, Scott Rothstein, what he did, what this man did, forging documents in various cases, forging judges' names. The man was a lawyer himself. He brings down his own 70-attorney law firm. And what did he do with the money? What did he do with the money? The usual, the Lamborghinis, the Ferraris, the Rolls Royces, 5 waterfront estates in Fort Lauderdale, one for Mama from the Bronx, one for the sister. You know what I'm saying? The big macho walks into a restaurant, everyone fell on their feet because here comes Scott Rothstein. Scott Rothstein, the great, great example. The great example. And where were all the people he gave his money to? All of the charities who kissed his behind. Were they in court when he was sentenced to 50 years? The mother was there and the wife was there. That was it. All of the charitable folk, to me, charities, by the way, most charities are Ponzi schemes unto themselves. I didn't say all. Most charities are Ponzi schemes unto themselves, where the operators of the charity live very royally, and very little of it winds up actually doing what the money's supposed to be doing. Incidentally, another scam artist for another day. So I've asked the question. There's also some interesting news. You got women winning primaries across the country, all Republicans. And the idiots in the media don't even report on it. Instead of reporting the sea change in California that Whitman wins and Fiorina wins, the local newspaper, the useless garbage newspaper, says Jerry Brown challenges Meg Whitman to town hall meetings. That's their answer? Now, I want to ask you something. They beat the men in the Republican Party. It's the year of the women all over again, only this time they're Republicans, so I guess their gender doesn't count. How many years have I told you that when a black is not a left-winger, he's no longer, he loses his value to the communists? When an Asian is not a radical leftist, he's never referred to as an Asian. When a Hispanic becomes a conservative, the Hispanic is of no value whatsoever to the left wing. He's not referred to by his heritage, and so forth and so on. So now we have women winning in California, in Nevada. Wherever you look, women, conservative women have won. And the newspapers make believe it doesn't matter because they're conservatives, therefore they lost their gender identity. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? It seems to me all of our civilization is either in collapse or upside down. And I blame it all on the media. I blame it all on the media. Every last problem we are facing in this country is a direct result of the vermin in the media. The twisted, sick minds in the media who have taken the prisms and turned them upside down and come up with a distorted Coney Island view of the world. Down is up is down, left is right, good is bad is good, cops are evil, criminals are good, the terrorist is a victim, the victim of the bomb is the real terrorist. Everything is upside down. The patriot is the enemy is the patriot, and we wind up with Obama, the alien in the White House. As a result of 40 years of twisting people's minds, we wind up with a man like Obama in the White House. But I don't want to talk about Obama. We know he's finished for now. The man has painted himself into a corner. He's been exposed as the king without clothes. The man is so clueless that instead of talking about the Gulf oil spill, I don't know who advises him, he starts talking about yesterday does a magical mystery tour about the health care again. He already sold that. He already beat people to death with it and pushed it down your throats with Nancy the Hammer. What's he going to talk about health care for? Instead of talking about dead birds. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. Now listen to the best from June of this year. Where are the giants? Where are the Jewish giants of today? Where are the Italian giants of today? I mean, let's be real here. You know what I'm talking about. I cringe. I read Rothstein. I read Madoff. I see Bonnie Frank. I see Rahm Emanuel. I itch looking at them. I itch. I ask myself, what the hell happened? Where's Einstein? Where the hell is Einstein when I need him? Where is any of them? Where'd they go? What happened? George Gershwin, Jonas Salk, Golda Meir, Edward Teller, Marc Chagall, Niels Bohr, Yasha Heifetz, Albert Einstein, Jewish giants. Look what we have today. Take a look what we have today. Scott Rothstein, Bernie Madoff, Rahm Emanuel. Yeah, I'm putting them all in the same category. Bonnie Frank, what, because they're in the government? They're honorable? Not in my mind, no. No, sir. I don't look up to them because they have power. The czars had power. The pharaohs had power. Did that make them good people? You know, there's a lot of blame for all of this. Did it begin inside the Reformed temples, the liberal Jewish temples? Did it begin in the Reformed churches? The relativism inside the churches, the relativism inside the synagogues that goes on today and passes for a gobbledygook religion, no reference to God, it makes them too uncomfortable, with no absolutes and absolutely no morality whatsoever because it might offend somebody. The Ten Commandments are laughed at. So you wind up with these people without a conscience. In any religion, there's something amiss in the world. So I'm asking you, where are the giants in any religion? So the you go into the blogs down here of the judge. What's interesting to me is they brought in a judge from Alabama, appointed by Bush, a real cracker. But he's got sort of, the judge says, the judge has a Jewish name. He says, the way it works is this. If it's a black criminal, they bring in a black judge usually. If it's an Italian criminal, have you noticed this? They bring in an Italian judge. Let's say they try to bring in an ethnic, let's say it's a Hispanic, they bring in a Hispanic judge. That's what they do. It's a very interesting thing that goes on here. So people can't say it's a racial thing. I've watched this for years. No one ever talked about this except me. You notice that? So they bring in a guy with a Jewish name who's as hard as nails, and he adds 10 years to the guy's sentence. He says, not only am I not going to be soft on you, I'm going to add 10 years to you. The judge gives this guy 50 years. The prosecutors only wanted 40 years. The defense attorney asked for 20 or 30 years. He gives him 50 years. They bring the mother out and the sister. They drag him out of there. Well, you got to read what the judge says. This judge was something. Finally, Judge Cohn spoke. He waxed poetic about Rothstein's case, saying that it was all about image, wealth, power, and influence, and that Rothstein rivaled Madison Avenue in the way he marketed himself. He said Rothstein's political connections stretched from the sheriff's office on one end of Broward Boulevard all the way to the Fort Lauderdale Police Department, on the other end of Broward Boulevard to the governor's mansion in Tallahassee and down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House, said the judge. He mentioned the society pages, the political contributions funneled through Rothstein's attorneys and their wives, his attending sporting events with big sports figures, all designed to create an appearance of legitimacy, but we now know it was all a facade, all a fraud. So he rips off people for $1.2 billion, and he started out as a poor schmuck in the Bronx.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
All right, welcome back to The Savage Nation. We're not talking about the beer garden party at the White House. We're going to talk about, well, I'm sorry to tell you, me. As some of you may know, a major profile appeared in the New Yorker magazine entitled Party of One, Michael Savage and Onyx Brigaded. And it was written by Khalifa Senna, who joins us now from New York City. Kay, welcome to the Savage Nation. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you again.
Now, I didn't know that you as a writer would, you know, break away from the normal shyness of a writer and appear on radio. I'm glad you did. My first question to you is this. Who do you think has lost more friends or listeners or readers, you or me?
You know, I can't say I've experienced any personal backlash. I've gotten a few emails from people I know who say, I listen to that show, too. I love that show. I can't believe
you wrote that. Oh, the secret savage listeners amongst the liberal intelligentsia. What has the response been from readers of The New Yorker? Forget your friends, if we may, for a minute.
You know, all the emails I've seen have mainly been positive. It's possible that they haven't been forwarding the negative ones to me. I'm not sure.
Sounds like my guys. What made you, you know, I said to my audience that the reason I went with your interview, even though I was skittish to do so, and you know it, because I was gun-shy from previous experiences with people who made me think that they liked me or, you know, really wanted to do a real story, is that you had been a jazz writer for the New York Times for years. Isn't that true?
It's funnier than that. I was a music critic for the New York Times, but one of the main things I actually wrote about was hip-hop, which is a world apart in one sense, but similar only in that a lot of rappers are people who are used to being attacked for various reasons in the media, and I was someone who kind of appreciated what they did with words. So if there's any connection, I guess that would be it.
Well, did you hear my rap at the beginning of the show called I Have Tattoos on My Soul?
I did. Are you looking for a record contract?
Well, I may move into that medium one day. So you were a music critic for the New York Times. I figured you actually listened to the music and didn't focus solely on the musician. And I figured, well, if you actually listen, you must be hearing what I'm actually saying. What was the most surprising item thing that you found out about me that you didn't think you'd find out about in doing this story?
That's a good question.
Okay, that I like Beck's beer.
No, I think it was that when I hear you on the radio, it's so vivid the way you talk, and there's so much passion. And to be honest, I was kind of expecting that, you know, when we sat down and when we were just discussing things, just us two, part of me kind of suspected that you'd be maybe different, that maybe the radio persona would seem like it was kind of just a persona, and then I'm talking to you in person and I'm getting a very different thing. And so so maybe one of the biggest surprises was that it was exactly the same guy. You know, the subjects we talked about might have been a little bit different, but a lot of parts of our conversation could have been exactly something that you would say on the air.
In other words, what you see is what you hear.
Yes, and I mean, maybe it goes the other way around. Maybe it's that when I hear you on the radio, it sounds exactly like what you would sound like talking to someone on your back deck.
It is true. I don't really change form very, very often. So you wrote about rap music. You were a music critic for the NYT. You now write profiles. I know you told me that you were coming out west when you interviewed me to interview a boxer. Did you ever get that profile done?
I talked to the boxer, and I found out that the day after I talked to him, this is an up-and-coming guy, not someone that people would have heard of, but the day after I talked to him, I discovered that the very next day, he got arrested on parole or probation, and got arrested on some sort of weapons charge. I don't know if he's been sentenced yet, but basically that story is on hold.
Who else have you profiled for the New Yorker?
The last big one that they printed before this one was the comedian Cat Williams, as an African American comedian, one of those guys who's hugely popular, but again, the readers of the New Yorker might not have necessarily known who he was.
You did that one.
Yes.
Okay.
And he's a guy who sold out Carnegie Hall and Radio City Music Hall, but kind of in sort of an underground way. And I was a fan of him, and so.
Wow. Maybe I should do Carnegie Hall. You could introduce me.
You could drive on in the little mini car.
Oh, the clown car. No, I drive. You know, I once did a live performance driving on in my '65 Cadillac. Everyone loved that one. That 65 Caddy, it represents America at another time. You know, thick glass when the chrome was thick and the women were straight was my opening line. It went over very well with my audience.
Looked a little bit like a Shriners parade.
Okay, we won't go there. What would you like your follow-up to this profile of Michael Savage to be? Meaning, I don't mean of me, but I mean, who's next?
Who's next? That's a good question, and I'd like to think that you know, maybe there's some people out there that would read my profile of you and think, oh, maybe I'll talk to this guy, maybe he'll be fair. I can only imagine that if someone ever came to me wanting to do an article about me, I'd be extremely skittish, no matter who they were from. And so
absolutely. But remember what I said to you toward the end of the evening after we went for Chinese food, and you said you wouldn't write about that part of it, and you didn't? You were true to your word. Remember what I said to you in the foggy night off Geary Boulevard? I said, Kay, I looked up at you because you're a tall guy and I'm not, and I said to you, you know, I mean, we're different in age by, what, probably 30, 40 years. I don't know how many years. And I said, you know, if we were kids in grade school, would we be friends? Remember I asked you that?
Uh-huh.
And what I said was, I said I would be your friend. And I don't know what you said. Did you say yes?
I said I thought that was pretty likely.
Oh, you're very, very, very cautious, aren't you?
I can imagine if that were the case, I can imagine some long, all-night discussions about all manner of things.
Where did you grow up, Kay? Where did you grow up? Here in the U.S., obviously?
I lived the first years of my life in Africa and then in Scotland, but I mainly grew up here in the Northeast, in Boston and Connecticut.
Now, am I allowed to say how distinguished your parents are? Would you mind if I mentioned it, or could you tell the people who your parents are?
I think it's all on Wikipedia anyway.
Okay, so, I mean, I was very impressed. And you could say it better than I can, because I think it reflects upon the son that they produced in the sense of your balance. I don't know how else to put it.
Well, as most children of parents can attest, my main goal is not to bring shame upon them. But
wow!
If
But not every child thinks that way anymore. So obviously they instilled a sense of responsibility in you, which is very, very something we share together. Your father is a professor, and so is your mother. Isn't that correct?
My mother's actually a senior lecturer officially. But, yeah, they're both at Yale University and teach fields related to Africa.
Amazing in that if someone were to look at your pedigree and someone were to say, this man would never do a fair write-up on Michael Savage, he would skewer him, and they'd probably be right 90% of the time. Why did you I got to ask the question another way. When you set out to write this, did you set out with a bias in mind?
Absolutely not. I think it's a few different things. One is that I don't think I'm not sure that skewering is what I'm best at, and certainly so I wouldn't have set out that way. But to be honest, I don't think I or anyone else would have been interested if this was just going to be a profile that just says, "Oh, this guy Michael Savage, he's a terrible guy." I don't think the editors would have even signed off on me wanting to do that.
Well, that's what you had written me. You wrote me such an email, and I actually believed you. And one of the reasons I was relieved when I read the article Monday is because I took a gamble on humanity. And it paid off. In other words, I had my faith in the journalistic element of humanity was reaffirmed. Okay, that's the absolute truth. I said, here it comes again. After what I've just been through with the 3 months of being a tar brush, so to speak, by the British government for quota reasons, I said, that's all I need now is another body blow. I was very pleased. I mean, it wasn't like you were my PR man. There's a lot in there that people could say is negative. But I don't see it as negative. I mean, when you said I'm still weird on the webcast, I was very honored.
I think so. And I imagine that your faith in mainstream journalism has been restored, probably briefly, I would guess.
Uh-oh. Yeah, I know what's coming tomorrow. Now, here's a weird question for you, talking about weird. The color drawing, the painting, the watercolor of me. Who in the heck did this? Because the person isn't credited here.
Let me look. I've got a copy of the magazine here.
I mean, it's not bad. They did catch my eyes. They really did. I trust the eye. But where'd they get that mouth, that, like, prissy mouth? That's not my mouth. I don't even know what picture they got it from.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know what they were using as the photo reference.
Amazing because it's somebody got a picture of me that I don't even know is on the Internet.
Philip Burke is the artist, and I don't, as you can imagine, all these things are so separate. I don't know anything about it.
Well, it's not a bad watercolor. Hey, I remember when I was a kid, there was a restaurant in New York that had all these famous New Yorker profile cartoons up on the wall. What was the name of that restaurant? Do you happen to know?
I can't remember. You're talking about the one that had the all the Al Hirschfeld drawings and stuff?
Yes. Yeah. That's the New Yorker, right?
Some of it, but the restaurant, I don't know. I'll never quite remember.
But is there such a place left in New York anymore, Kay?
am I allowed in? If there is, I'm not.
Oh, well, if you're not allowed in, I'm not going in either, or let's vice versa. If I'm not allowed in, I hope you won't either. But it's a very interesting question because I'm fascinated right now with a series on TV called Mad Men, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah.
All right, so I got season one, season two. Last night I watched season one. I couldn't stop watching it because it's quintessential Manhattan, 1959, 1960, with all of the incredible bars, you know, the interior shots of that kind of bar where the men all wore suits, the women were all dressed to the nines, the hair was done, the nails were done, the guys had perfect hair. I mean, does that New York still exist?
Did it ever, really?
I don't know. It didn't exist for me. Because I can't stand wearing a suit and tie.
Although, like many things on TV and in the news recently, it does make me thirsty just thinking about it.
Thirsty. I know where you're going with that one. Well, when you go back to the New Yorker, do people at all say anything to you, such as, why did you pick him? Or why didn't you do a hatchet job on him? No one would dare say that to you, would they?
It's a very polite office, so you don't get negative feedback anyways, but I've gotten probably more positive feedback from this than from the other pieces I've written. I think part of what people liked about it is that, you know, you were talking about it on the air, and it really felt like a conversation between these two institutions that wouldn't normally be expected to have a conversation.
I'm speaking with Kay Sanna, who wrote the profile of Michael Savage in The New Yorker, and I really encourage you to go out and buy it. I don't make any money from it, and Mr. Senna doesn't make an additional royalty if you buy it. The reason is I want the world to know that conservatives read, because I think there's a general misconception that conservatives drag their knuckles and don't read, that they don't read anything except perhaps the Gun Digest, which I read. I like gun magazines, but not to the exclusion of anything else. If you have a question or a comment, this is your one shot in life to ask it of our guest right here on the Savage Nation. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Here's a caller out of Los Angeles, KGIL. Tom, go ahead, please. You're on the Savage Nation.
Yes, hello, Michael. Pleasure to speak with you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I went to go pick up the article in Encino Barnes & Nobles. Really excited after you've been talking about it for so many weeks. And having it in my hands, taking it home, opening it up, and finding out that the middle section of the magazine was completely torn out.
Now, we could look at that one of two ways. A fan who was poor stole it because they read Abbie Hoffman where he said, steal this book. Or they ripped it out because they hate my politics. Which one do you think it is?
Well, initially I thought it was because they hated your politics. So when I went in there today to exchange it, which I got a good copy, I looked through all the other copies and they were full. So I happened to think maybe somebody really wanted to read the article and they couldn't afford the magazine for whatever reason.
All right. Not a bad call. Very interesting. Do not rip the article out of a magazine. Buy the darn thing. Kay, can you stay with us for a couple of minutes?
Sure, of course.
We're speaking with the author of Party of One in The New Yorker, Kay Senna, right here on the Savage Nation. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. We'll be right back. Savage. The Form of Savages show, the quick cuts from one topic to another, the way familiar political observations give rise to baffling digressions, the fluctuating tension between his blue state life and his red state message, turn off the music, is at least as important as its content, which means that it's hard to understand him and his appeal at second hand. The immoderate quotes meticulously cataloged by the liberal media watchdog site Blankety Blank, insofar as they reduce a willfully erratic broadcast to a series of political brickbats, are accurate but misleading, says the author Kay Senna, who wrote the profile of Michael Savage in The New Yorker, which I recommend you go out and buy. Let's go to Medford. Jenny, quickly, you're in Medford, Oregon. What's your comment?
Dr. Savage, I'm a huge fan, and I packed up my two little babies and drove 20 miles to the local Barnes & Noble, and when I got there, they were completely sold out. So I just want to let you know you have a huge following in Medford.
God bless you. Thank you very much. You see that, Senna? Your magazine, your editor should be very proud of you.
And we've just learned it. We've apparently from the caller before that, we learned how people could save $4.99 and just
no, don't do the Abbie Hoffman. They're liable to go out and do that. Oh God. Okay, let's go to line five. Trip in Chicago. Quick comment.
Hi, I was wondering if Mr. Senna had any comment or opinion on the state of the mainstream media, particularly print, and if he thought it was generally balanced.
That's an easy question. Kay, care to comment?
I think it's almost impossible for any newspaper or magazine to be balanced, let alone the media as a whole.
That's absolutely true. In other words, how many times have I said the same thing? I admit that I'm subjective, and I admit that I'm biased. I mean, I try to support my positions with facts or any kind of persuasion I can come up with, but fundamentally, this is a medium of subjectivity. There's nothing objective or scientific about what people think.
And I think that a big part of what's changed over the last few decades is that people who feel that way, detect that bias, have so many more options now and so many other places to go to and so many other voices to listen to.
Yeah, you're right. And that's why people think that the other guy is biased, because they see many other opinions on the Internet. Fort Lauderdale, Ed, welcome to the Savage Nation. Question to comment. A comment from Mr. Senna.
Question is for Mr. Senna. Mr. Senna, you know, I understand your parents are professors and everything, but is there anybody in your family that actually that reminds you of Dr. Savage with any that shares any of the same views?
That's a good question. I think I think when I listen, you know, it's funny when I listen to him, I can imagine that. But to be honest, none of my relatives really live in this country, so I don't have the experience that that a lot of other people have of you know, talking to their uncle or someone at a family picnic or something. So,
Kay, isn't your father a theologian?
Sorry, say that again.
Isn't your father a theologian?
He's a historian of religion.
Okay. And that's very interesting. So, but he studies what, African religions or Christianity? Which one?
He studies Christianity and Islam. Mainly.
Okay, so but when you were a child, I don't want to delve too much into your personal life, but when you were a child, would your father read to you from both the Quran and the Bible?
No, it wasn't like that. But certainly, you know, I think I would like to think that he, you know, taught me how to think critically about things and have that kind of a perspective. But I wouldn't. It's you know what he does. You know, he's, you know, like a serious scholar, and I'm very self conscious that I'm a guy who writes for a magazine, which is a job I like, but a very different sort of job.
We're out of time, and I recommend everyone listening to the show who enjoys the Savage Nation, and who loved hearing the honest voice of the author, Kay Senna, who wrote Party of One for The New Yorker.
Savage.